You are listening to a broadcast from LifePoint Community Church in Greenville, South Carolina. Wherever you are at this point in life, we hope and pray that God will use the following message as a source of help and encouragement as you listen.
We are in a series called Why Should I Believe? And we're covering some of the foundational truths of our Christian faith. And asking the question very boldly, why should we believe in these things? Let's not just assume that they're right. Let's not just assume that the Christian faith is right and true. Let's ask the question, why should we believe? And of course, for the last 3 weeks, we've been looking at the issue of why should we believe in the Bible? I hope that that has been an encouragement to you and a strengthening of your faith in the truth and the accuracy and the life-changing power of this book. Today we turn a corner and we ask the question, why should I believe in God? This again is another topic that is so enormous that I just had to pick a few small things for us to look at this morning to try to answer the question, why should I believe in God? And I want to tell you, this question today is one of the most critical questions that anyone can ever ask in their life. In fact, I would go so far as to say the entire meaning of human life is affected by whether men see themselves as supreme beings in the universe, or whether they acknowledge a God who is either a force to be denied or a Lord to be obeyed. All of human life hinges on that one issue. Do we see ourselves as supreme beings in the universe? If so, that changes everything. Or do we see God as the supreme being in the universe? And if we do, then we have a choice to make there. Are we going to deny Him? Or are we going to choose to live our lives in surrender to Him? How do we know that God exists? How do you know God exists? Can you tell me? It's kind of a hard question. The Bible says something in Psalm 14:1, which is a very offensive statement, if you want to know the truth. It says, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. Did you catch that? It's saying that a person who does not believe in God is a fool. Wow. That bothers me a little bit. Does the Bible have the right to make that kind of a statement? I mean, that's offensive, isn't it? It kind of is. Surely it would have been better if the Bible said, you know, you do your thing and I'll do my thing. And if you don't believe in God, hey, that's okay. Let's just do our own thing. Can't we just get along? Can't we all just, you know, be happy? I'll tell you, Psalm 14:1 brings it to a point where there is absolutely no confusion about what it's trying to say. And I'll tell you, that's what I love about the Bible. The Bible doesn't pull punches. The Bible doesn't try to coddle us and make us feel good about ourselves. The Bible says, these are the facts. You got to make a choice. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. How can we prove God exists? Well, I believe the evidence is overwhelmingly in favor of the existence of God. I don't even think there's a contest. And we're going to look at just a little bit of that evidence today, just a few pieces of evidence. The first thing, I want to share three things with you this morning, three main things. The first thing is the evidence of intelligent design in the universe. If you have your Bibles open to Psalm 19, chapter 1, let's look at the first four verses together. Now listen to what this is saying. It says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. What? The skies display knowledge? What does that mean? Verse 3. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world. I find it personally a remarkable stretch of the imagination and an absurd stretch of logic to think that the clockwork precision of the universe and the extraordinarily detailed design of human life, animal life, and plant life could have evolved, could have occurred by accident over the process of millions of years just by simple chance. Everywhere you look in the universe, you see brilliant, purposeful design. Everywhere you look. And to believe that all of that design, all of that order, that precision could have evolved from chaos is really a stretch of faith. I mean, the second law of thermodynamics says that everything is moving towards a state of disorder or a state of randomness. To think that order can spring from chaos by itself is really, really pushing the edge of logic and reason, to say the least. Everywhere we turn in the earth, we see the fingerprints of, dare I say, God. If the earth was slightly smaller, our atmosphere would be impossible, like that on planet Mercury. If our earth was slightly larger, our atmosphere would be filled with free hydrogen, like Jupiter and Saturn. It'd be impossible for us to breathe. The Earth is exactly the right size that it needs to be to sustain human life. If the Earth was a tiny bit closer to the Sun, we'd burn up. If the Earth was a tiny bit further away from the Sun, we'd freeze to death. It would become a block of ice. The precise tilt of the Earth's axis as it flies around the Sun gives us our heating and cooling, gives us our seasons. The rotation of the planets is so precise that we set our clocks and our calendars by them, and we have for thousands of years. The moon hasn't spun off into outer space. They keep revolving and revolving in precise clockwork. It's almost like they were designed to do that. Everywhere we look, we see order. We see design. And when you see design, it's a hint that there must have been a designer. This shirt that I have on, I know you're not going to believe this, but this shirt that I have on, it's a pretty nice shirt, right? This actually resulted from an explosion in a cotton mill. Now, don't laugh. There was a cotton mill, a fire started, the cotton mill exploded, and it happened to be across the street from a scissor factory. Right down the road was a button factory, and they all just exploded together, and the result of which was this shirt. Now, how believable is that? We laugh at that, and yet people think, they're buying into this idea that this order, this precision that we see all around us, from the furthest galaxy, hundreds of billions of light years away, down to the tiniest subatomic particles that we can see, and we haven't seen it all yet, by the way. We haven't invented microscopes strong enough to see the universe inside those particles yet. In everything that we see, from the big to the small, we see the fingerprints of a designer. It's amazing to me that archaeologists can dig up a clay pot with handles and with an opening and with etchings on it, and they say, aha, evidence of humankind. They know that that pot did not evolve from the dirt over millions of years into that shape. They look at that shape and they know immediately there must have been someone who designed that. And yet those same people can look at the extraordinary universe and all of its intricate details and precision and believe that it just got there by chance. When you see a painting, you know there must have been a painter. When you see a building, you know there must have been a builder. And when you see creation, surely we know there must have been a creator. When you walk outside and you see rocks lying around, or you see a big, huge rock on a mountain, you don't really think anything of it. You look at it and you say, well, that's a rock. But what do you think when you see this rock, Mount Rushmore? The heads of four former U.S. presidents are carved into that enormous mountain. Has there ever been anyone in history who has looked at Mount Rushmore and stood there and said, honey, look at that? Can you believe that over millions of years, wind and rain has beat against that rock and it has slowly eroded away and revealed that shape right there? Who would ever think such a thing? We look at Mount Rushmore and it's a rock, but we see something in that rock that tells us it didn't get that way by chance. It didn't get that way just simply by evolving that way. Somebody made that. No one would argue with that statement. There had to be a designer. When you walk along the beach and you see footprints in the sand, you don't say, well, look at there. Look what the ocean did. It washed up on the sand and it created these patterns. Look, there's a right foot and a left foot and a right foot and a left foot with toes and the whole thing. Isn't that incredible how the ocean just created that pattern in the sand? Nobody thinks that. We see those footprints and we know immediately that they had to be made by a person. How is it possible that people can see the creation, the detail, the things that just baffle our minds in the world and believe that it just occurred? We look at nature. I mean, I didn't even know where to start on this message of sharing things with you. But just take nature, just a few things from nature. And we try to figure these things out, and we still can't. It's too much for us. Honeybees fly with a remarkable agility that would be the envy of any stunt pilot. Nate, you love flying, right? You want to be a pilot someday, maybe fly fighter jets or whatever. So you're into that whole thing. Pilots look at honeybees and they scratch their heads because they say, man, if I could fly like that, I would be the world's greatest pilot, the tiny little honeybee. And yet their navigation software is packed into a brain the size of the head of a pin. Bees have airspeed gauges, gyroscopes, and a compass that detects the polarization of sunlight. They have UV sensors to track the horizon so that they can gauge tilt. And they have two compound eyes, each with over 7,000 hexagonal facets on them. And when a bee goes out and finds food, the bee flies back to the hive and it performs a dance. The other bees gather around that bee. And the bee, scientists have watched this. They've put cameras in the hive. They've studied it for decades. The bee comes back and it performs a dance. And based on the pattern of the dance, based upon the speed of the dance, based upon the angle of the bee's wings, it is communicating the precise coordinates to the other bees of where that nectar is located from the hive. And the bees watch this dance, and then they say, let's get to work. And off they go. And based on that dance and the rhythm and the pattern of that dance, those other bees leave the hive, and they know exactly where to go to find the nectar. Probably just happened by chance. When I dance, there's a whole nother outcome that happens, because I just, you know, I ain't got the whole rhythm thing. You know, when I dance, dogs start to howl and, you know, all kinds of bad things happen. But that's an amazing, amazing thing. Who taught bees how to build honeycombs in that perfect shape every time? Who taught them that dance? I wonder. Kevlar. You ever heard of Kevlar? He was that famous Russian scientist. No, he wasn't. Kevlar is that material. It's the strongest fiber, the strongest man-made fiber, Kevlar. It's used in bulletproof vests. And yet, Kevlar is completely outclassed by the simple humble spider web. Did you know that dragline silk, which is sort of the support for the spider web, is 100 times stronger than steel? In fact, a cable of this silk, no thicker than a garden hose, could hold up 2 fully loaded Boeing 737s. That's how strong it is. And it can stretch to 200% of its length without breaking. Scientists don't have a clue how to mimic that. They've tried. Every time they've tried, they've failed. They cannot make a cable ratio-wise as strong as a simple little spider web. Every autumn, salmon begin a remarkable journey from the ocean at just the right time. Some of them have been tracked by scientists with radio devices. They put little tags on them. They have traveled, they've been known to travel hundreds and hundreds of miles from the ocean back to the stream. They swim up the stream against the current. They jump the rapids. They fight obstacles. For days and days and days, they swim and return, you know where, right? To the exact location of their birth. The exact spot in the river. And then the mama fish takes her tail and she waves it real fast over the gravel at the bottom of that river, and she lays her eggs in that exact spot where she was born. How does that work? Migration of birds is another thing that just absolutely amazes scientists and researchers. Each bird species has its own route. Each bird species has its own departure and arrival dates for their migration, and they each migrate in their own unique way. Barheaded geese fly over the Himalayas twice a year and go as high as 26,000 feet to get over this obstacle. Each year, the Arctic tern makes a 25,000-mile round-trip journey between the Arctic and the Antarctic, and they know exactly where to go. We've never yet seen a bird pull off at a gas station and ask for directions. Never happened. We've never seen a bird with a TomTom satellite device strapped to its neck so it can figure out where to go. They know exactly where to go. National Geographic last September printed this incredible article about the bar-tailed godwit. Now, I know, Chip, you're totally into birds, and Sarah, you too. I don't know if you've ever seen the bar-tailed godwit. It's probably not really in our neck of the woods. But listen to this. They put tiny satellite tracking collars on these birds, and they track them by satellite in their migration. They were found, that is unbelievable, they were found to have flown 7,145 miles non-stop across the Pacific Ocean from Alaska to New Zealand without taking a break for food or drink. Researchers are looking at that going, there's got to be something wrong with our equipment. I mean, there's no way that can happen. I was talking to Chip about a year ago about the migration of certain birds and how they can track them on satellite, and it just looks like a dark cloud over the earth. Hundreds of thousands of birds crossing the oceans every year, flying day and night to get to where they need to go. Researchers understand a little bit, maybe, about the different methods that they use to find their way, even at night, to know exactly where they're going, but they just haven't figured it out yet. Guys, we could go on and on and on with examples from nature itself. How do those animals, how do those birds, how do those fish and insects know to do all those things? Well, nature is one amazing facet of God's creation, not to mention the human body. Now, I don't have time to go into this. I just want to touch on two things. I brought these out a long time ago in a sermon series we did called What a Mighty God We Serve. If you missed that, if you weren't here then, I'd encourage you to listen just even to those first three. in that series because it is absolutely amazing to see the creation of God. Two things. The human eye has been called the most complex computerized mechanism known to man. Remember I told you about how when a baby is developing in its mother's womb at just the right moment of development, there are 1 million optic nerves that begin moving out of the optic nerve center in the brain, and at the same time, 1 million optic nerves begin moving out of the back of the eyeball, and they start coming towards each other. And every one of those 1 million cables has unique connectors. Number two will not match up with number 4,027. Number two has defined number two. Number 300,048 has defined number 300,048. And every one of those 1 million optic nerves have to find each other and connect to the right one before you will see a single thing. And it happens thousands of times a day all around the world as babies are being developed inside their mother. How in the world can you explain that? It's a remarkable thing. Something that they don't tell the kids in the school textbooks is that Charles Darwin himself, in his infamous book, in a chapter called Difficulties with This Theory, said, listen carefully, this is Charles Darwin. He said, quote, "To suppose that the eye with so many parts all working together could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree," end quote. They don't tell you that part, do they? You can read that in his book. Even he looked at that and said, oh, come on, I don't even know how that thing got formed. Just the human eye put a dent in his whole theory. He didn't know how to deal with it. Your body contains approximately 75 trillion cells. 75 trillion. I don't have time to go back through and describe to you what a huge number that is. 75 trillion cells. Scientists have found that the genetic code from just one of those cells, you know the genetic code that they just kind of unraveled a few years ago, the cGTNA encrypted thing. The genetic code from just one of your human cells contains enough characters to fill up 6,250 page books. That's the genetic code from just one of your 75 trillion cells. And every one of those pieces of code has to be in exactly the right sequence for you to be you. Or else you'd be an orangutan or a leaf on a tree or something. It has to be right, precisely right. And inside each one of those cells are complex factories with little machines moving around, little trolley-like things that carry stuff from one side of the cell to the other, little doors that open and close, all of this happening at the microscopic level. You remember one of those little machines we talked about called the bacterial flagellum? You guys remember that from that series? I had to just bring this up again for those that weren't here. Here's a diagram of this thing. Okay, this is a fully functional working motor. And these things right now as you sit here, I know it kind of creeps you out, but those things are buzzing around inside your 75 trillion cells. These are sub-cell particles. And yet, when they invented a microscope big enough, strong enough to be able to see at that level, what they discovered was the bacterial flagellum motor, and that's just one of thousands of mechanisms moving about inside your cells. Some of these machines run at 100,000 RPM, and they can stop and reverse direction within a quarter of a turn. Scientists have called these the most efficient machines in the universe. They have a propeller, they have rotors, they have bearings, and they have a drive shaft. Dr. Michael Behe coined the phrase irreducible complexity when talking about the structure of these microscopic motors. And he said, quote, "Each part has to be assembled in exactly the right sequence. If just one tiny part is missing, none of it will function, end quote. And no scientist has ever been able to explain how all the parts of those miniature machines could have possibly been built and assembled through the process of evolution. There is such mind-boggling organization inside every single cell in our body that no reasoning person could conclude that it just happened by chance. You look at that thing, which for centuries we didn't even know existed, and you say to yourself, that's intelligent design. There has to be a designer. I'll share with you one more thing I shared back then, because I love this quote, and this man, I've read a lot of his stuff, and he's just an amazing guy. Sir Frederick Hoyle, that's his fancy title. He's commonly known as Fred Hoyle, which I like Sir Frederick Hoyle better. But in looking at these things, here's what he said. He said, the probability of that happening by chance, referring to this thing being assembled by chance, is, quote, about as likely as a tornado whirling through a junkyard and accidentally assembling a fully functional Boeing 747. There's just no chance. There's no chance. If you go to the store this afternoon and buy a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, take it home, take the lid off the box, and dump the pieces out on the table, you will have a higher probability of all of those pieces falling in exactly the right spot and assembling that puzzle, infinitely higher probability of that happening than of all of this coming about by blind chance. Try it. Let me know how that works out for you. Romans 1:19 says this, and I'm through with this point. It says, what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Guys, I'll tell you what, that last statement really rattles my cage. That really bothers me. God says, all you have to do is go outside and look around. You will see me everywhere you look. And I want you to know that because of that, you're without excuse. It's a strong statement. Not only do we see God through the intelligent design of the universe, but secondly, we see him through a universal sense of right and wrong that exists. It's interesting to me that in human nature worldwide, regardless of the continent, the culture, or the color, there is a moral code stamped in the hearts of man. There's an inner sense of right and wrong that exists. And if humans evolved from a swamp, where in the world did this moral foundation come from? Where did this moral code, this sense of right and wrong, come from? See, the thing is, even atheists have a sense of justice, and they get angered if it's violated. But the irony is they can't have it both ways. If there's no God, then where did that moral foundation come from? You have to ask yourself. The moral code inside man suggests a moral being is the original cause. If there's no God, there's no right and wrong. There's no good or evil. If there's no God, the weird thing is, no atheist can object on moral grounds if you want to kill him. He can't. He has no basis to deny you that right. If God doesn't exist, there's no good or evil, there's no right or wrong. If you say, hey man, I'm going to steal your wallet and then I'm going to kill you, and he says, whoa, wait a minute, you can't do that. Why not? Well, because that's not right. Based on what? Well, the laws of our country say it's illegal to steal and to murder. What are they based on? And the further back you dig trying to find the core, trying to find the beginning of all of this, you have to land on something. The Bible gives us the answer of where that moral code comes from. Either we have a God who stamped his moral code inside of us and to whom we must be accountable, or we have to abolish all laws because there's no absolute truth upon which anything can be based. It's just your opinion against mine. Romans 2:14 says, even though they do not have the law, since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. The Bible is saying that written on the hearts of mankind are the laws of God. You just know it inside. There's a sense of right and wrong. In any culture you go to, their laws are different than ours, but in any culture you go to, and I've traveled the world, everybody has a sense of right and wrong. Without God, somebody has to tell me what the foundation, what the core, what the genesis of that moral code is. Does primordial slime have a sense of right and wrong? Did it impart that to us when we crawled out of the swamp? Or did it come from God? There's a universal sense of right and wrong. There's so much we could talk about on that point, but I want to move on to the last point. Number three, I didn't really know how to word this. I took several runs at it. This is the best I could come up with. It might not make sense. The universal need to worship. This is really fascinating to me. How you can travel the world to the farthest lands, to the most remote people on the face of the earth, and you know what you'll find in every culture. There is a hardwired need to worship something. It's just in there. It's in everybody. Different people worship different things, but it's all in an attempt to reach out and connect with some higher power, something greater than themselves. There is this drive inside everybody. Some may say, well, you worship and you believe in worship because you believe in the Bible, and that's the only reason. Not so. Not so. There are primitive tribes who have never seen the Bible, who have never heard the message of God, and you go and visit those tribes, and you know what they'll be doing? They'll be worshiping something. They'll be worshiping something. It's built inside of every person to some degree. Farrell Jenkins, in his book Introduction to Christian Evidences, said this: men in all the world and throughout all time not only believe in deity of some kind, he's referring to, but also engage in acts of worship and devotion. The religious principle is extremely potent in all nations, dominating their thought and history. Everywhere, the human heart has a craving for God. There will be exceptions as individuals, but the exceptions do not invalidate the rule. Listen to this. The atheist is an exception in every society. End quote. The atheist is the exception in every society, he says, because in every culture in the world, people are driven to worship something. Where does that drive, where does that urge come from? The thing is, if God doesn't exist, then life is nothing more than a cosmic accident. Have you guys ever thought about that? If God doesn't exist, this whole thing is nothing more than one giant cosmic accident. Our lives have no purpose. Our lives have no meaning whatsoever. We live, we die, there's no point to any of it. It's all meaningless. Everything is random. Everything is pointless if there's no God. We may as well live however we choose to live. Listen, if that's true, if God doesn't exist, if God didn't create us and stamp his moral code in our hearts and put within us a desire to seek him and to worship him, if none of that is true, then we might as well live however we want to live. Let's just steal and rape and lie and cheat and kill and do whatever we want to do because nothing matters. Nothing matters. It's just meaningless. Well, I guess it's kind of hard to show you a comical video after that statement, but maybe this little 40-second video will help just break the ice and show you this point. You guys seen, well, I know you've seen the Apple commercials on TV, right? Have you seen those? All right. This little video is kind of a takeoff on one of those Apple commercials. Watch this.
Hello, I'm Creation.
And I am the theory of evolution. Why are you so happy?
Oh, are you kidding? Because I have hope.
Hope?
Mm-hmm. You know, and the assurance that I have a purpose.
A purpose?
Mm-hmm. You can have one too, you know.
Don't want one.
What are you talking about? Everybody wants to have a purpose.
That's not true. Some people want to hold to the unproven fact that we're nothing more than a bunch of protoplasmic goo that evolved over billions of years and will end up as cosmic garbage, therefore serving no one or no purpose at all.
No hope or purpose?
Right.
That's so sad.
I think that kind of gets the point across. You know, really? I mean, if this just kind of came about by chance, we have no hope. We have no purpose in this life. 1 Corinthians 15:19 says it this way, if only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. That's the truth, folks. See, we need to understand that for every longing inside of man, for every deepest longing that exists inside of him, there is something that satisfies it. Food satisfies man's hunger. Water satisfies man's thirst. There must be a God who satisfies this universal need to worship. There must be a God. Where would that have come from otherwise? Ecclesiastes 3:11 says it this way, God has set eternity in the hearts of men. That's the answer to why there's a universal need to worship. Because God has put that link with him into the hearts of every single man. Blaise Pascal said it this way, there is a God-shaped vacuum in every man. And Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. Hey, you know, I'm sure most of us in this room today are on board with what I've been talking about. We believe in God. But there may be somebody here, there may be somebody listening over the internet who is just really battling with this whole issue. Man, I just don't know. God? How can you prove there's a God? Well, today I've looked at just a few basic objective things to try to point us to the fact that there must be a God just because of what we see around us, because of what's going on in our heart. Next week, I want to bring you a message that I believe points to the greatest reason that there is a God, and that is the gift that he sent to us in his son, Jesus Christ. We're going to talk about that next week. Why should I believe in Jesus? How do we know he just wasn't some kind of a kook? How do we know he was who he said he was? It's a critical question. But maybe you're here today or you're listening online and you're just kind of on the fence on this issue. But there's one thing you know for sure, and that is that inside of you, in the quiet moments of your life, there is an empty space that you've tried to fill in 1,000 different ways and you've never been able to fill it yet. I want to tell you this morning what that empty space is. It's a space that was made to be filled by God alone. And the beautiful thing is, this God who is awesome and powerful and mighty and holy is the same God that loves you so much that he's pursuing you right now. And he wants you to reach out to him and to give your life to him. He created you for himself. Let's bow our heads and take just a moment. I'm going to give you some time. Our music team can come on up and take their place. I just want to give you a moment to reflect on this message. again, as I said, I'm sure most of us here today are already on board with this, but you know, you never know. There may be someone here who's just kind of been doing the church thing, and they've never really come to a point in their life where they've given their life to the one who made them. Folks, if God exists, we've got a big question to face. What are we going to do with him? Is he just a force to be denied? Or is he a Lord to be obeyed? It's not complicated at all to give your life to God. You don't have to say any certain words. There's no special prayer that you have to pray. All you have to do is, from the sincerity and the faith in your heart, just call out to him right now and say, God, I need you. I believe in you. And I want you to come into my life and change me and give me new life and give me hope and a purpose in life. And he will do that. Jesus said, all who are weary and burdened, if they come to me, I'll give them rest. Father, I thank you for the way that you've revealed yourself to us in so many extraordinary ways. We would have to try to miss you. We'd have to work at that. Everywhere we turn, we see your handiwork. We see your fingerprints. Father, I thank you for revealing yourself to us, for not just being a distant cosmic God who sits aloof in heaven and doesn't care about us, but for being a God who came near, a God who sent his Son to die for us, to restore our relationship with him. I thank you for that. And I thank you for the wonderful evidence that we see everywhere we turn of God. And I pray if there's anyone here who's never come to you, I pray that today would be the day they would reach out to you. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
You've been listening to a broadcast from LifePoint Community Church in Greenville, South Carolina. More teaching resources are available from our website at lifepointcc.org. If this broadcast has been a blessing to you today, we would love to hear from you. You can contact us directly from our website, or you can write to us at P.O. Box 27036, Greenville, South Carolina, 29616, USA. Thanks again for listening. May God bless you.